Welcome one, welcome all. This is the Next Step Radio Show, brought to you by Infowarts.com and rebroadcast on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio, right in the middle of Ben Johnson's Paragon Radio. Big thank yous all the way around for everyone who makes all of that possible. I am your host, Jacob Appleman. That's J-A-C-O-B-A-P-P-L-E-M-A-N. You can find me on Facebook that way. You can reach me by email at thenextstepradioshow@charter.net and the website www.infowarts.com. That's infowarts.com. Yes, the new website is coming. Please be patient. It's a lot of hard work and I'm a one-man show. So, this is episode 27 here on the Next Step Radio Show, and we have a very special guest this evening. The topic is 2012. And yes, you may say that is a very big topic, and I agree. So we're going to go to one of the most researched and scholarly individuals on the topic. His name is John Major Jenkins. He has a website, alignment2012.com. That's alignment2012.com. If you get on your favorite search engine and type John Major Jenkins, J-E-N-K-I-N-S, and go crazy. He's a wealth of knowledge. He's a fantastic author. And he will shed light today with us on what exactly this Mayan calendar thing is about, a good way to frame the 2012 topic in our minds as we approach that date. The music this evening, that is Pak Chin. It's Mayan music from an artist named Alfredo Raul. Before we get things started with John Major Jenkins, we're going to hear a few words, like always, from our good friend Talam Acey in his piece called Sell Hell, because in the 2012 category, this is a very fitting piece by Mr. Acey, because there are lots of people that want to sell you hell. John Major Jenkins, on the other hand, he's a peddler of knowledge. He is a vessel of experience and a scholar and a gentleman. So again, we've got Talam Acey coming up. Right after that, we'll get into our interview with John Major Jenkins. And the music tonight is from Alfredo Roel. That's Mayan music, Pak Chin.
I said, I don't believe in hell, but we can sell it. Tell them we're the anointed agents of salvation. Sinners. The only way to be forgiven is if you're living within a system of precepts and suppositions that we prescribe. Tell them a book that was assembled by the Nicaea Council from a hodgepodge of religious text was literally written by God. Think for yourself and burn in hell. Infernal blazes, ignites hair, singes bone, melts faces into the faceless. We alone determine what faith is. Heaven may or may not exist, but they need to believe. We own the keys to eternal peace. Christ said, the only way to the Father is through me, and the only way to Christ is through us. Plus, tell him there's a demon powerful enough to the Father, Almighty Creator, and we're the ordained soul negotiators, and they will pay us to save them from hell, which I don't believe in. But we can sell it. I mean, they're already scared. They're already living amongst violence, disease, decadence, and fear. They're already living amongst rank smells, garbage, ghetto slums. This is hell on earth. And the key to our influence and convince them that the afterlife can be even worse. I mean, it's the oldest game in the world, so we might as well keep playing it. Just like the Egyptian god, amen, ain't got nothing to do with Christianity, but it works, so we keep saying it. Just like the Old Testament has about as much to do with the news as it has to do with the Quran. As it has to do with hellish wars like the Crusades and the conflict in Vietnam. Tell them God commanded tyrants to destroy entire societies and leave no man, woman, or child behind. Don't allow them to know that God is love. Tell them God is vindictive and jealous. Tell them God ain't for the peaceful and the tolerant. God is for the superficial, self-righteous zealots in which the simple and judgmental are relished. Well, I do not believe in hell, gentlemen. But I promise you, We can sell it.
Thank you, Talam. Now, without any further ado, the author, the researcher, and the sharer of wisdom, John Major Jenkins. We'll get right into the interview like usual with a little bit about his background.
Well, I was very interested in science and philosophy when I was younger, and then I became more interested in philosophy and Eastern mysticism when I was still in my teens and got involved in yoga and meditation. And these pursuits led me to have some direct experience with inner gnosis. And my readings ranged over a lot of different philosophical areas before I became directly interested in Native American and specifically Mayan teachings when I was about 21. At that point, I was a young guy and I had decided not to pursue college at that time because I was more engaged in reading and studying things that I wanted to, which included books like Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism by Lama Anagarika Govinda, things like that, you know, and the works of Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung, and Alan Watts was a writer that I enjoyed reading, so philosophy stuff. And but then, being somewhat having some wanderlust going on, I decided to get south of the border, and I read a book by Frank Waters called Masked Gods, and that was about the Hopi Indians in the Four Corners area. And since I was living in Colorado at the time, I went down and visited the Mesa Verde cliff dwellings and Chaco Canyon, and that really solidified it for me that I could design my own trip and get south of the border. And I was reading the travel books, and I realized that there were Maya people still living in the villages of Guatemala. So I basically worked a night shift job at a medical supply company for about a year, and I saved up $1,000. And that was the money that I used to for my first trip. You know, back then you could do, you know, $3 hotels and stuff like that, and travel around, hitchhike, bus, train, that kind of thing. So the $1,000 lasted over 3 months. And that was the first trip that introduced me to the Maya. And it was such an amazing journey for me, you know, also visiting the archaeological sites and so on, that I basically dedicated my life to working with the Maya people in a political capacity, service work, helping to rebuild schools, delivering relief supplies. And I started writing journalistic pieces that I was getting published in a newspaper in Chicago that was run by my brother. My brother had a peace and music festival that he used to do in Chicago, and they had a newspaper that went with it. So I was kind of like a roving journalist in the field, writing about the death squads in Guatemala and so on. And so by about 1990, I became more interested in the philosophical or esoteric content of the Maya material, and reading the inscriptions and understanding the philosophy and the calendar. And so I started studying that. And of course, one encounters, even at that time in 1990, one encounters some of the popular writings. At that time, it was basically José Arguelles, The Mayan Factor, things like that. And I had a distinct adverse reaction to those kinds of things, because even with my minimal knowledge of the basic facts of the Maya calendar at that time, I could see that he wasn't really playing with a full deck. He didn't really care that much about the basic fundamental facts of the calendar, but instead was sort of creating his own sort of cult system. Inventive, for sure, but it seemed not really that fair to the surviving Maya, who still were following the 260-day calendar down in Guatemala, which I had direct experience with on my, by that time, several trips that I had taken to the traditional areas. So by that time, I was still in my mid-20s and still traveling, and started doing the research, and you know, continuing to forsake following a traditional path into, you know, academia or something like that. I was living in Boulder, Colorado, and I actually applied at CU in Boulder and got accepted as a non-traditional student in 1991, but then realized that I'd have to go into guaranteed student debt in order to even get through the bachelor's program. And at that time, I felt like I didn't want to waste so much time and money on what appeared to me to be basic level courses. And so I just went down the path of the independent self-taught researcher, and everything kind of unfolded from there, and I was publishing books and continuing to, you know, get down south of the border, and the 2012 thing came up for me around that time, and the research into that really unfolded in the mid-90s, and I was able to pursue that in kind of a focused way, living very frugally on the margins of society. I basically lived in a renovated garage without running water outside of Boulder, Colorado, and worked a part-time job to pay my bills for about 4 years while I was doing the research, you know, getting the books out from the library. And I was very excited. It was a very intense and exciting period because I felt like I'd found the key to understanding this 2012 material, and that whole period of time culminated in the publication of my book, Maya Cosmogenesis 2012, in 1998. So that was really, really the beginning of the whole thing, and it's really only been, I look back on that whole time, and it's only been like 13 years, but it certainly seems like a lot more has happened in that 13 years than one might think.
Right. So in the very broad category of 2012, I think most people are familiar just with the phrase the Mayan calendar, but that's a study in and of itself because they had more than one calendar. And if you could just briefly kind of describe their calendrical system without, you know, the nuts and bolts of degrees of accuracy of every single one of them, but they had kind of a cycle. If you could just elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. Well, the basic building block of all the Maya calendar systems is the 260-day calendar, which is called the Dzogchen, and it's still followed today in the highlands of Guatemala. It consists of 13 numbers combined with 20 day signs. So 13 times 20 is 260, and this is kind of the key to the whole matrix of the Maya time philosophy. And it has connections to human processes of unfolding. 260 is basically about 9 months, and it's explained by the Maya of today that it corresponds to the 9-month period of human gestation. So that's neat. You know, that's an interesting biological use of that magic number 260, but it's also the interval between the planting and harvesting of corn in the highlands of Guatemala, so that's agricultural. But most importantly, it's the key to the almanacs, the Maya calendar almanacs that can predict astronomical cycles of Venus, eclipses, Mars, and so on. So we see that this magic 260 is a key to the different realms of human experience. And so it allows us to see how all the different domains of human experience are intricately interwoven. It's like that as above, so below principle. The processes in the sky are reflected in the basic rhythms experienced by human beings and in agricultural earth cycles as well. So that's the basic building block there. But the long count calendar that gives us the 2012 period ending date is a different system altogether. It's basically nested periods of 20 days, and you have basically 5 place value levels. So you have the day cycle, then you have the 20-day cycle, and the 360-day cycle, and the roughly 20-year cycle, and then a cycle of just under 400 years, which is called a baktun. And it's 13 of these baktun cycles that gives us the great cycle of 5,125 years, 13 baktuns. And it's this 13 Bakhtun cycle that's coming to completion on December 21st of 2012. So scholars know these things because they've reconstructed how the Maya calendar corresponds and correlates with our own calendar. And so they know how the calendar fits into a time scale that we can understand, you know, with our Gregorian calendar. And so we know that the cycle ending falls on December 21st of 2012. This is one of those items that popular writers in the marketplace like Carl Kalaman and others prefer not to understand. I mean, it's really not even a question of ignoring it or something. They aggressively pour a lot of energy into creating disinformation around this fact. The correlation is settled, you know, if it's understood.
Right.
So it's something that I've written about going back to my book Zolkin in 1992, which was published with Borderlands Science Research Foundation out in California. It was my first book that I got published, and it was a little 1,000 print run edition, and you know, I think you can still find copies out there every once in a while on eBay and places like that. But that was kind of a breakthrough for me back then. But I dealt with the correlation issue. I dealt with the Maya-Venus calendar, which is another interesting system that you find in one of the few surviving Maya books, the Dresden Codex. And so these are the basic fundamentals, you know, that I spent actually 4 years up to the point of publishing my book Zolkin in 1992, studying the correlation issue in question. And I found that, you know, Jose Arguez had invented his own system with the 260-day calendar. And Carl Kalaman came along later, and he just, you know, completely disregarded the 2012 period ending date. So these are the kind of problems that one has in the marketplace. And then later on, of course, you had somebody like Daniel Pinchbeck, who is really a latecomer to the discussion and really just is recycling a basic idea that Frank Waters put on the table in 1975. It's that idea of Quetzalcoatl being the deity that transcends dualities, you know. And then Pinchbeck gets celebrated as a pioneering thinker because he says that or something. It's ridiculous. You know, it's a derivative recycling of an old idea in the whole Maya calendar discussion. And then what Pinchbeck has done is that he's sort of given permission to divorce 2012 from really needing to have any reference at all to the Maya or the Maya calendar. And so he sort of transcends or disregards the whole question of the Maya calendar and how it's placed correctly and all this kind of stuff by just using 2012 as a general icon on the marquee of, you know, his, you know, advocacy for, you know, shamanistic use of plants and consciousness and all that kind of stuff. So that's another area of the problem with the current state of the discussion.
So with all of your firsthand and academic research of the calendrical system with the Maya, I guess the most important question is that will there be a 2013?
Well, yeah, sure. That basically goes to one of the many misunderstandings about the calendar, and it's basically driven by those bumper stickers that one sees endlessly repeated in documentaries and books and book jackets and so on, you know. The Maya predicted the end of the world in 2012. No, they didn't. The Maya calendar ends in 2012. No, it doesn't. It's cyclic. It's part of a cyclic time philosophy, you know. So in the same way that, you know, the calendars come to a completion in one of their cycles, but then a new cycle begins. So, I mean, your question also goes to a question that basically can't be answered by anybody.
Right.
Will there be a 2013? Well, I don't know. Maybe the Earth will spontaneously explode for unknown reasons. Does that mean that the Maya predicted that? No. Well, I don't see any evidence at all that the Maya were predicting that kind of thing. In fact, what I've been able to do is to show how this calendar system is linked up with the creation mythology. You know, you have the mythology, and then you have the calendrical system that also involves astronomy, and you have this interwoven sort of cross-information going on between these systems in the Maya time philosophy, such that the Maya creation myth is explaining spiritual teachings, and they're spiritual teachings that do relate to cycle endings, but the teachings are oriented towards how to successfully facilitate a transformation and renewal. They're not about harping on or focusing on or belaboring some kind of apocalyptic doomsday scenario.
Right, and the explanation of their the 260-day calendar, if somebody's familiar with the fractals or sacred geometry or embedded patterns, that's kind of a perfect example, because human gestation in that 260 days roughly, to the fetus, what comes after that 9 months technically is the end of the fetus, but it's also simultaneously the beginning of the infant. So there's a transition point that's, not apocalyptic in the sense that, everything, comes to a crashing halt. But it's more of, like you said, a transformation and renewal, because there's the ending of the fetus is actually the beginning of the child. So it's kind of a continuum, and on the larger macrocosm, or the zooming out on the fractal, that idea kind of portends with the 2012 date, being the end of a time cycle simultaneously beginning anew.
Yeah, and with the possibility or even the probability of opening up to a bigger cycle or a bigger reality. And so this gets into the deeper part of the discussion. And with that very good point and question and comment that you brought up there, it's important to stress that, to say that the Maya didn't predict the end of the world, or, it's not that the calendar ends or that time ends or something like that, that doesn't mean that the whole 2012 thing is just some kind of joke, because then that's the pendulum swing to the other side, and that's basically what the professional Maya scholars and debunker types like David Morrison at NASA tend to do. They only look at the silly meme of doomsday that's put out by the media machine, as well as exploitative writers in the marketplace like Lawrence Joseph, who wrote the book Apocalypse 2012. And so it's easy to just say, no, that's not correct. It's not doomsday. And so let's all just, close the book and go home for the day. Well, that just does the whole topic a huge disservice, because as you are aware and as you pointed out, there are these analogies going on, these teachings, these scenarios, this understanding of reality that one can perceive in a study of the Maya calendar, and has to do with the relationship between the microcosm and the macrocosm, and how we human beings go through these cycles. And in the Maya creation mythology, you find these very, very profound and challenging and interesting teachings that, as I pointed out, connect into the perennial wisdom teachings around the globe that one finds in Hinduism and Buddhism. So one can't just dismiss 2012 as being some kind of a hoax or something like that. And that's another one of the big problems, is this reactionary debunker type of psychology that goes on. And that's just a level of superficiality in the whole discussion, that it's got to be, first of all, to say that, well, I think you get what I'm talking about there.
Sure, yeah.
There's a larger thing. There's a larger issue going on. Yes, we can say that the doomsday meme is a silly joke, that's been peddled by doomsday pimps in the marketplace. And so let's get beyond that, and let's get into the real, challenging, profound information that exists in the Maya material around 2012.
Right, because it's more than about a calendar. It's a way to view time as we progress through, life in the universe. Because, one day is an extension of the previous night, and a child or a parent to the following night. It's this constant cyclic
nature of reality that I think they're trying to express, not that any one day is more important or less important than another, but there are transition points, you know, just like birth and just like death, you know, and just like, you know, germination and fruiting in the plant world. There's a better way to view time than just a linear progression, you know, from zero to, you know,
exactly.
One followed by 37 zeros.
Exactly, Jacob. Yeah, you nailed it with that. And it is the problem that arises to a large extent in this whole discussion, and the source of a great amount of the misinformation or misunderstanding is linear time versus cyclical time. So what you have happening in the 2012 discussion with the aggressive projection onto the 2012 date, which is a Maya artifact or concept, is an artifact of Maya time philosophy that basically relates to the cyclic time concept, in which at the end of a cycle there's a renewal into the new cycle. And that is the nature of transformation and renewal in a cyclic time philosophy. It is the end of a previous cycle, not necessarily a catastrophic, apocalyptic end. In fact, that idea is something that's required in the linear time philosophy of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which, of course, the Western world comes from. And so what you have happening with 2012 is this appropriation or co-opting of an idea from the Maya material that has nothing to do with catastrophic apocalypse, and it's being co-opted by the doomsday obsessed Western time philosophy, which, you know, requires that history ends in some kind of apocalyptic catastrophe. So the psychology of all this is pretty interesting to look at, and that explains what I've experienced in my many years of trying to do documentaries with Western media sources like the History Channel and so on, is that they just are going to assume, you know, that it's about doomsday and catastrophe. So it's really a travesty, and it's my hope that as we, you know, that as there's going to be a percentage of human beings that can see through the BS and want to get into the deeper discussion of what, you know, the real information is about, because the real information is available. You know,
right.
It's there in the creation myth, and it's at the Tortuguero site on the inscription Monument 6. It's there at the origin point of the Long Count calendar, as I've reconstructed it at the early site of Izapa in southern Mexico. That was the focal point of my early research in the 1990s, going to the origin place of the 2012 calendar, Izapa, and looking at the monuments there and the astronomical orientations. And so that information is out there. And, you know, you would think that Izapa should be the focus of a documentary. And I've done dozens of documentaries, and each time I say, okay, you're doing a documentary on 2012. Let's go to the origin place of the 2012 calendar. It's a place called Izapa in southern Mexico. And there was only one place that I was able to get to go there, and that was NBC's Startling New Secrets documentary that came out about a year and a half ago. And, you know, they did a fairly good report on some of the monuments that I've been working with around the area there, but unfortunately they didn't really utilize a lot of the material of the ball court information at Izapa and the alignments there. So I think it still needs to happen. Here we are. You know, I've been doing documentaries for 13, 14 years now, and I have not been able to get... right now I'm working with a place, and we'll probably be going to Izapa this year. So it's my hope that there's still time to get the accurate... real information onto the table.
And I have a follow-up question to that, but just before when anyone even speaks of apocalypse, you know, the Greek root there means an unmasking or an uncovering. You know, the root word of revelations is to reveal. So these aren't I understand how they got associated with catastrophe and doomsday, but in their genuine sense, the message there, you know, with these celestial events is an unmasking and is a revealing. And it's Mayans aside and calendars aside, I'm curious sometimes as to how people can't just simply look around and not see some type of transformation in progress. It's not a point like a light switch that just goes boom. You know, there's a lead up to and a lead out of, you know, this the infinity, like the point in the infinity sign in the middle. You know, you're drawing into it and you're also going out of it. And for people to not be able to look around, you know, we went from horse and buggy and candlelight and two generations later to, you know, space flight and, you know, podcasting. It's a radical transformation is underway. And that's,
yeah,
you know, whether, you know, Kalaman's 10/28/2011 date or the other gentleman's February 19th, 2013, that is almost irrelevant in the larger scope that, you know, several thousand years ago, these people were able to predict, you know, within a 0.001 percentage, accuracy, that this transformation is underway and it is being revealed and uncovered and unmasked all around us. So, I always say experience is the ultimate truth, and I've experienced this unmasking myself, and to correlate proper research into my own experience, they have to jive. And the sincerity of what the Mayans were trying to relate is accurate past, you know, what we call computer accuracy. I mean, within three decimal points, they nailed it. So, you know, regardless of the specific hour, they were pretty right on, because the unmasking and the transformation is obviously underway for those willing to open their eyes and see it. But you yeah. brought up – oh, go ahead.
Well, I believe that with the accurate correlation, with the correlation of the Maya calendar, we know that the 13 Bakhtun cycle end date is December 21st of 2012. So that's a solstice.
Right.
And then I believe, you know, in my research, I'm able to show that it's quite apparent that the Maya were intending this date to mark a rare astronomical alignment. So we do have a reference to an empirical thing, you know, an empirically measurable astronomical alignment. It's called the galactic alignment or the solstice galaxy alignment. And this is really the key of my reconstruction work on a kind of a nuts and bolts level. And I've been able to show how this alignment idea is present at the site of Azapa and in other Maya traditions like the ball game and the creation myth. And now, lately, on the 13 dates on the inscription from the Tortuguero Monument, which has the 2012 date on it. So what I'm trying to get at here is that, yeah, you know, the Maya were very accurate in making this forward calculation that gave them the rare alignment of the December solstice sun with the galactic equator, which is basically the midline of the bright band of the Milky Way. And so our sun on the solstice is lining up with the frame of the galaxy. And then there's mythological or symbolic features that are also involved in this astronomical alignment that the Maya incorporated into their ball game and spiritual teachings and so on. But what I'd like to point out is that what you have going on hand in hand with that are the spiritual teachings that highlight how human beings have a choice. You know, there's not some kind of fated thing that's going to happen because of this alignment. Now, as an aside, on a scientific level, one should question and be interested in whether or not galactic alignments of this nature, it's an empirical, real thing, do stimulate change on the planet in the same way that the Earth's motion around the sun creates the seasons, and there's certain things that go on with that. Not so much astrology per se, it's just an understanding of the changing angular orientations. And I don't have an answer to this. I think this is something that astrophysicists should look at. I mean, you have astronomers like David Morrison at NASA who aren't really doing their jobs when it comes to an analysis of the galactic alignment. First of all, he in particular has to separate out the empirical basis of the galactic alignment as I defined it in my galactic alignment book and as the European astronomer Jean Mius defined it in his book Mathematical Astronomy Morsels, which came out in 1997. David Morrison needs to try to get away from the doomsday apocalypse BS in the marketplace, because that's all he's responding to, and he's conflated the galactic alignment with Planet X coming in and all this other silly stuff. Now, if he and other astrophysicists would look at the galactic alignment, they might find that there's unrecognized principles or laws, scalar waves. I have no idea. It's not my department.
Right.
My work has been to reconstruct Maya astronomy and how they understood these things and embedded these things into their creation mythology. So in that direction, what I've been able to do is show that there are spiritual teachings associated with this, and it does underscore how we all have a choice. You know, we live in a field of definite empirical things, but we still have a choice in how we respond to things. For example, we know that the sun will rise tomorrow, but we have to choose to wake up.
Right.
We could stay in bed if we wanted to.
Or another analogy similar in that line of thinking I tell people is kind of like a video game. The ultimate beginning and the ultimate ending are all pre-programmed, but you can be Mario or Luigi or the princess, or you can turn right or left, or, you know. And the other neat thing is, even though you only have three lives, once you die, you can start over again.
Well, here's the thing that's really cool and how this all does go to a deeper discussion. And it's sort of like, on one level, it's meditation on one's mortality.
Right.
And it gets into those perennial philosophy teachings that I'm so happy to explore and put on the table, which I did do in my recent book, The 2012 Story. I have chapters in there on the perennial philosophy. It's stuff that people need to reacquaint themselves with. Because the New Age literature, as it's currently sold in the marketplace, has gotten so far away from it. I mean, we need to go back to the book by Aldous Huxley in the 1940s, which was called The Perennial Philosophy, to get a handle on the basic information here. And it's basically that, as you said, you know, the ultimate beginning and the ultimate end are pre-programmed, in a sense. Like, and what that's about is that we, as incarnated beings, come out of the eternal divine ground, and we return into it after we pass out of this incarnation. That's the ultimate beginning and the ultimate end, is the eternal, infinite, divine ground of all manifestation. So that's pretty interesting to contemplate. If it's eternal and infinite, then there's a part of our being that connects into that place. And in fact, you know, this is no you know, strange thing, you know, to contemplate. In fact, the mystery schools that were in place, you know, thousands of years ago, understood these things and understood further that human beings could have an initiation, an experience of that divine ground as it exists at the core of our beings, beyond the limited consciousness that's enforced upon us by ego and the minions of egoism. And we do have an ego, and that serves a purpose, and that's fine. You know, that's part of our limited incarnated identities. But we also have this divine ground from which we all come and to which we are all going. And the mystery schools of, say, the ancient Greeks, for example, and the mysteries of Eleusis provided that direct initiatory glimpse. And the founders of Western philosophy, strangely enough, Plato and Socrates, they all had the experience at the mysteries of Eleusis. So in the modern world today, we basically live in an idiocracy.
Right.
You know, we live in donkey stan, especially in America. I'm sorry to say, but we've been so dumbed down, and we've been so, you know, so much drivel has been shoved down our throats by the media and to a large extent by the educational system that we don't know up from down. You know, it's really a sad state of affairs. But as I do point out in my various writings, we do have the free will choice to sacrifice our attachment to the illusions, and a lot of that revolves around egoism, and open up to this bigger picture, reconnect with the divine ground, you know, reconnect with the higher wisdom, the bigger picture. And it's that bigger picture that we can all have an initiatory glimpse of that can provide the solutions, you know, help us create a sustainable world, you know, and I think that's the challenge right now.
So with all of your research and up until this point, what is, you know, I think mentally, what's in framing the whole context, you know, there's the alarmist crowd and the, you know, storable foods and ammo crowd. And I'm not referring to that kind of preparation, but so in your experience in education and research, what can one do to prepare for the transformation and change process?
Well, sometimes I don't really know how to answer that question. I've been asked that question a lot, and I think it doesn't necessarily get hung on 2012. I think it's a question that human beings can and should be asked at any point in history. You know, it's as applicable to 17th century Frenchmen as it is to 21st century Bostonians or something. You know, it's the question of how one lives life correctly and rightly, and how one can fully actualize their humanness. You know, and I guess it gets to those perennial principles of compassion and openness and mindfulness. And I guess to answer your question more directly, I would say that everybody can benefit from having a meditation practice, you know, whatever it is, wherever you're at in your process in your life, calming the mind, bringing a focus, letting go, you know, watching the endless chatter of the mind and letting go and getting into that deeper field of the meditative process. I've advocated Vipassana meditation specifically in the past because it has a certain focus on the still point between the out-breath and the in-breath. And those still points, I think, can provide that initiatory glimpse of what lies beyond the polarities.
And that's interesting because I had stumbled into that myself, actually, in a severely deep meditative state once, where that was what was being told to me, is to let go, just let go. And I kept insisting that I have to breathe. You know, I have to breathe. If I completely let go, I'm not going to breathe. And they said it's right in between breathing in and breathing out is where you let go.
Yeah.
And I stumbled into that myself. So when I've heard you discuss it, I thought, wow, you know, this same intelligence is everywhere, apparently.
Yeah, well, you had the higher wisdom come through, and that is very possible. That is the heart of the idea of gnosis, you know, that, you know, knowledge can come through sort of the senses, or the way that science does it, you know, by collecting data and making charts and graphs and postulating laws and principles. And, you know, that kind of understanding of reality will only relate to the more surface aspect of reality. But real gnosis, understanding the deep integrative interwoven nature of all the different domains of reality, comes through a lot of times for people meditation. One can also have glimpses of these kinds of states or wisdom if you fall in love. You know, being in love can provide that. A lot of people are intuitive. A lot of people have dreams, you know. So it's everywhere out there. We just need to cherish that more. We need to celebrate that in ourselves and in each other more, so that we can all work together to open up to the bigger picture, and how, you know, focus on relationships and partnerships and creating, you know, sustainable future.
And just creating in general. I think we've been so programmed to consume. That's where a big part of the imbalance comes from, that the creation part on our end has turned into purchasing consumerism instead of creating, whether it's a relationship or beauty or art or music. You know, we've been taught to devour, and we've come to this, you know, bizarre inequilibrium of consuming nonstop that that the answer to that is to back up a little bit and be more creative in any sense.
And make choices. Like I really like what you were saying about like a lot of these demands on our time and energy that sort of determine our behavior really comes from the media. And you were saying of how you have disconnected from cable and broadcast television in your home. I think that's a wise choice. You know, I've done that as well here in Colorado, and because it's so insipid that the commercialism that tells us this, that, and the other thing, how we should smell and how we should behave and how we should think and what kind of car we should drive, and consumerism is really something that's driving the global situation, you know, into the ground. And to the extent that we are programmed by that, they don't call them programs for nothing on
right.
TV. And to the extent that we fall prey to those things, then we are just giving away our power. So it's really about taking back our power as human beings. And what can be more fulfilling than getting together with friends and playing some guitars and talking about things and connecting as human beings have connected, you know, for tens of thousands of years.
Right. Yeah, because when I talk about solutions with people, whether it's gardening or homeschooling or, you know, exercise or meditation, you know, a common rebuttal is, you know, well, I don't have time for that. But if you disconnect the TV, you know, on average, there's 3 to 6 hours.
There you go. Exactly.
That's where the time went. It's right there.
Right, right. And those are glittery distractions that are keeping us from, you know, being real. And in fact, in the My Creation mythology, there's a deity that appears at the end of the cycle. His name's Seven Macaw. He's a bird, and he squawks loudly, and he magnifies himself, and he distracts people with his glittery ornaments. He's basically vain egoism, and he's keeping people from seeing their true natures, basically, seeing the big picture of which they're a part. And this is one of the creation mythology teachings that applies to 2012, because as I wrote about in my recent book, The 2012 Story, we do have a real situation going on in the world in which the Seven Macaw system is ruling and ruining the planet, and we've all bought into it. So it's really our conscious free will choice to dissociate ourselves from that. In other words, to sacrifice Seven Macaw, or more specifically, sacrifice our attachment to those illusions that feed the Seven Macaw system. And then we can open up to the bigger picture and sort of reawaken. It's really about awakening. Awakening to the big picture that we've lost.
Right.
And then we can really start. That's the first thing that needs to happen, as we were talking about earlier, how all real change has to come out from within. And to awaken within yourself is sort of the precondition for really affecting real, permanent, positive change in the world out there. You know, it's sort of like spiritually inspired political activism. If there's going to be any kind of political activism, it has to be spiritually inspired. Like even the demonstrations in Egypt right now, in Cairo, you know, I think that that's coming out of the heart of the people, you know, that they are, it's not just about violent demonstrating something like that. It's about that heartistic spiritual desire for, you know, fairness and equality and freedom.
Right. And since we're getting close to the end here, with this being solutions minded, another component to your body of work that I find fascinating in the solutions category is self-publishing and self-study. And maybe we can tie both of those together since we've only got about 5 minutes. Let's, if you'd like to just talk about self-publishing and your concepts and ideas of how we can proceed forward in a better manner through book writing and also self-study, since like I read in one of your papers, there wasn't a college course on Mayan studies, you know, so sometimes you just have to go get your hands dirty and teach yourself, and that can be far more rewarding, beneficial, and insightful than, regurgitating a professor's point of view of a textbook written 100 years ago.
Right, exactly. Yeah, well, the self-study thing, I think, has to do with just following your bliss. For me, that's been a certain path, but there's many paths. And we live in a time of so much information, and it's not just meaningless information. It can be, practical things as well. And one thing I always found interesting is that years ago I found a copy of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Thodol, the old Evans Wentz translation. That I found it at a garage sale for 50 cents or something like that. And I was like, wow, this is cool. I've always wanted to read this. And then I realized that, this was a secret guarded book for centuries in Tibet and China, it was a sacred text that was not let out of the monasteries for the general public to read. And here I am in the 20th century, and I can find it at a garage sale for 50 cents. So we live in an era in which a lot of information is available, and we don't have to be confused or feel like we're bewildered by all that. We can pick and choose what we want to pursue. And one of the things that I've become interested in, and I've always been interested in, really, is like graphic arts design. And this basically gets into how producing a book can be a creative act on many different levels. And the modern consumerist strategy of book publishing is that quantity, like high sales is the way to do it. So in the process of creating an offering or a product in which you're going to have the maximum amount of high sales, quality goes down. They're trying to find that lowest common denominator, which is going to appeal to the largest number of masses out there. And in that process, you lose a lot of quality. In the actual content, the actual intellectual content of the book, as well as the design ethic that goes into the book. And I've worked with many different publishers now over the last 18 years, and it's been on again, off again with that thing. As an author, I can barely suggest different kinds of fonts to use, for certain different parts of the text, let alone graphic design elements. I mean, they'll let you use images and illustrations, but my point is that I'm very excited about pursuing in my own path, getting back to basics with traditional letterpress printing and producing limited edition, high design concept, hand-bound books. And it's a path with a heart, and it's kind of like what William Morris did at the Kelmscott Press in the 1890s. It's like producing high-quality offerings in which a book is a beheld object of art, really. And with that in mind, then it gets us back into the quality side of the equation, quality rather than quantity.
Right. So you're, and the point I'm trying to make is, if people are interested in authorship or conveying and expressing ideas that may be against the grain of the mainstream, there is still the ability not only to self-publish, but to self-print and to actually make a book in your garage is still feasible without, a million-dollar investment club or something.
Sure, exactly. And I think this is especially appropriate for the 2012 topic, because I've been beating my head against the mainstream sort of dissemination of this real information. And I've found, in my research, this really profound information, and apparently it's not the kind of information that the mass media marketing machine of publishing can really be effective in getting out to people. In other words, the publishing industry is geared towards mass production and mass audiences, but I guess I've learned that the 2012 topic in its real authentic state is not fit for mass consumption, apparently. Apparently, that's what I've learned. I sort of really don't believe that.
Right.
But I think it's because of the way that the machine is set up. You know, they want you as an author to write to a third grade reading public level. You know, that's a process called concision, by which, you know, inside of the mandate of concision, you're going to lose stuff. You know, it's like try to write in terms of bumper stickers or something like that. You're going to lose the real context of the information. So, yeah, so what I'm trying to do then is just to offer information for the people out there that identify the people out there that want this kind of information and then make that available to them.
Well, it's fascinating work. We're about to round it up here. In my massive amounts of research, 2012 is a huge topic. Self-publishing, solutions, you know, all of these things kind of converge in John Major Jenkins. And for that, you know, in my own personal path, I thank you because, you know, your work has definitely inspired me. Has given me a good, focus and grounding and direction. And for that personally, I like to thank you. And for the audience who may or may not be aware of the full body of your work, if you want to, here in the closing moments, plug anything and everything John Major Jenkins, books, websites, anything you'd like.
Well, the recent book is The 2012 Story, which can be purchased through Amazon or eBay or your local bookstore, independent bookstore. If there's one in your neighborhood, feel free to order it through them. Or you can go to my websites. I offer other things on my websites. I really don't sell my books directly on my websites anymore. But I do have a special 3-CD audio program that I offer, a special deal with a DVD presentation, and that can be found on my alignment2012.com website. That's really the website that I've had in place for about 16 years now, alignment2012.com. If you Google John Major Jenkins, you're likely to find a whole bevy of websites that I've had up for a while. One is called update2012.com. And I actually have my sort of personal blog page now up and running. It's johnmajorjenkins.com. And that actually has a lot of fun stuff on there, some of my guitar songs and poetry and stuff like that, just for fun. And that'll also give access to the recent breakthroughs on the Tortuguero inscription that I've been working on as well on an academic level. So lots of good stuff out there, and I appreciate everything that you're doing as well. Power to the people.
Absolutely, because that's where it has always been and continues to reside. We've just been fooled into thinking we're little and tricked into giving it away, but I think slowly but surely, through things like community radio, the internet, podcasting abilities, the heart of the information and the sincere people are able to connect. Synchronicities and things will beat us all over the head until we get enough critical mass that the true nature of things will rise to the surface. And that's one teaching and realization I've always come to, is that, no matter what, it's going to be okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree.
Well, I can't thank you enough.
I appreciate the time you put into this and for getting the information out there.